You're listening to First Words, a podcast where creativity, career, and kids collide. We're your hosts, Jasmine Aluma.
And I'm Casey Gates Fry.
Today's guest is Bode Abodurin, also known as Papa B. He is a writer, speaker, businessman, and stay-at-home dad. Bode is on a mission to communicate his rapidly changing beliefs on fatherhood and masculinity in real time, following his recent conversion from climbing a corporate ladder to running a household and family business.
Bode, originally from Nigeria and currently residing in the UK, is the father of three children and the author of Fatherhood by Papa B, a game-changing guide for parents, father figures, and fathers-to-be, recently published by Penguin Random House.
Can you tell us when you knew you wanted to be a father?
Ooh, what a question to start with. I've got to be honest with that one. There was no point that there was no special time where I figured out I want to be a father. One thing I did know was whilst growing up, I was looking forward to a time when I'd have my own family and, you know, have my own household and have my own children, because I was quite eager to do things differently. You know, from when I was young, I always had a feeling that I wasn't quite happy with a lot of the methods. So at the back of my mind as a young kid, I remember myself thinking, you just wait. When I have my own family, when I'm in charge of my own self and my own time and I have my own children, I'm going to make sure they don't feel the same way I feel. So I think from young, I already had that feeling. So there was no specific time that I felt, yes, you know what, I want to be a father now. No, none of that. That's just never happened to me.
What did you learn about masculinity from your father?
What did I learn from my father about masculinity? Mm-hmm. What I learned was men are to be stoic, you know, void of emotions, strong, go to work, provide no matter what. And that's it. Just no emotions whatsoever. Be strong. There's a time when I was younger when I think I was crying because I got bullied by some of my classmates. And I remember getting smacked by my dad for that, you know, coming home crying. And I was getting bullied because he goes, no son of mine is going to grow up. In his words, he used the word, I mean, he is older, so he used the word sissy. No son of mine is going to grow up a sissy. And he smacked me for that and says, why are you crying that, you know, you got bullied by boys that your age? You should go out there and fight them and stuff like that. I kind of get the message he was trying to put a pass across, but I guess his delivery was totally off. But that was it. That was what I learned from him. Just be strong. No emotions whatsoever. Understand that you're on this world and what you say goes, and you should not be questioned, and that's it. So that's what I learned from my dad in terms of masculinity. So, you know, that toxic masculinity stuff. Yeah. All of that.
It's really clear that you made a conscious decision to do things differently.
Absolutely.
So given that was your early training and exposure to the definition of masculinity, how would you define it now? How would you redefine that?
I think it's important to know where we're coming from, to know where we're going, or know where we want to be. I define that version of masculinity as, in a nutshell, toxic, doesn't help anyone, it's detrimental, doesn't move us forward as a race or as a people, you know, as a species, doesn't move us forward. Just like I said, doesn't help anyone, even us men that tried that actually, you know, show that version of masculinity, doesn't help us either. My definition of masculinity now is a man should essentially embrace both masculine and feminine, you know, both masculine and feminine attributes. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong in actually feeling. There's nothing wrong with leading with your emotions. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. My version of it is just feel. If anything, just feel. That's most important. Take your time and feel. It's so important. And it's something I say to a lot of my male friends now. I'm like, feel. Feel the moment. There's something happening to you. You don't like it. That's okay. Things happen. But feel it. You need to go through the motions. Because only then you'll be able to actually learn what you're supposed to learn from such from that episode or that scenario or that moment. I call it a sliding door moment, you know. That's only then you actually learn something from it. When you feel it, you understand it, you become one with it. We just go with it. The patriarchy has a lot to do with the ideas of what it means to raise boys, who then go on to be men, fathers, and so on and so forth. As a parent, I have come to understand that it is one of my duties to guide my children on how to behave. This takes time and patience, a lot of patience, in fact. Put it this way, your children are sponges who learn from you by soaking up their environment. And if your answer to most things is a smack or another form of physical discipline, which, let's face it, comes from a place of anger, you are showing your children that the only way to deal with conflict is violence. Do you see the problem here?
How did your relationship with your mother impact your perception of fatherhood?
Ooh, see, my mother, right? My mother was a visionary, and she's still a visionary. And I don't think she quite understood what she was doing. I don't think she understood. I don't think she knew what she was doing at all. I think deep down inside, she just felt this is not right. Okay. Upon further investigations, I found out that her father is exactly the way I am now. Mm. So she grew up in a household or with a father or with a dad that felt a dad that embraced those side, you know, that side of things. So to her, you know, getting married to a man like my dad, again, that's what society pushes, isn't it? A man like, you know, that's a man. That's the kind of man you want to be with. That man's going to protect you. It just didn't sit right with her. So when I was growing up, I was the one that she dragged into the kitchen to learn how to cook. I was the one, not my sisters, because I've got two younger sisters, but I was the one she always took into the kitchen. I was the one that she taught how to cook and clean and do stuff. You know, things that society would define as largely feminine roles. You know, she taught me to do all of that. And she used to say stuff like, I'm teaching you to cook now, even though I didn't want to do it. She said, I'm teaching you to do that. Nobody would take you for a ride. So when you grow up and say you decide to get married to a woman, she's not going to make you go hungry. You got to learn to look after yourself. And that was what she always said. And all those times when dad would want me in the kitchen, want me in the living room, watching the news with him at 5, 6, you know, like, I don't want to be doing that stuff at that age, but he want me sat down watching the news with him. She wanted me doing other things. She wanted me to learn how to wash my clothes and stuff like that. I think from a very young age, she was kind of enforcing those things subconsciously. She was just sowing those seeds in my head to make me understand that doing all those things doesn't make you less of a man at all. Actually, it makes you a complete man the moment you're able to actually do that kind of stuff and essentially just look after yourself. Because if you can't look after yourself, how do you expect someone else to look after you? It just doesn't make sense. So yeah, she was a visionary. And till this day, we talk about it and laugh about it. And she goes, yeah, I knew you were going to turn out like this. I knew you were going to turn out like this. This was my goal. And, you know, the fact that you're this way, I've won. That's what she says. But it's all good.
Yeah. And so in the early days of your fatherhood parenting journey, especially when your children were younger and in diapers and there was all that interdependence that is required from your children, can you talk us through what the division of labor was in your house at that time?
So I've had two chances at this, you know, I've had two tries at this, and I've learned through the first experience I had in terms of having a young child and, you know, starting a young family. I've got to be brutally honest, and I'm very honest about this in my book, where I said I reverted to original programming initially, right? Because that's what I knew, even though my mother was there seeding the other side of things. But hey, that's the first man I looked up to, my father. You know, that was the example I had. So I reverted to original programming, and I just felt, well, I'm a man, I'm working, I'm putting food on the table, I don't need to do anything else. You can't tell me what to do. You can't tell me how to spend my money or how to spend my time. You know, as long as I'm putting money on the food in the fridge, there's nothing else I have to do. You know, that's your role as a woman. And of course, we all know how that relationship ended. You know, it's in my book. You know, it ended because she felt she deserved better than that. And rightly so, she most certainly did. It took for that to happen for me to actually understand. That was like a reprogramming for me. You know, that took me right back down to earth and say, right, hold on a minute. you got it all wrong. You know, those things that you felt whilst you were growing up, you felt these things weren't right. Because even though you were young, you kind of understood what was going on. Because I think we need to give children a bit more credit. They understand stuff. You kind of understood what was going on. But of course, you reverted to original programming and this happened. What did you expect? So I had that moment of really just reflecting on my actions and my past actions. And I just decided to make those changes because it starts with us, isn't it? You know, we all grew up in a certain way and we've all got some kind of trauma or, you know, we've all got experiences. But it's what we choose to do with those that really matter. If we decide to change the narrative, we might be onto a winner. And that's exactly what I did. I decided to just change it and say, look, that stuff doesn't work. That stuff doesn't make me feel good about myself. That stuff doesn't help anyone. That stuff most certainly doesn't help the child or the children. And that was it. I mean, so obviously my second try at it, like I said, I just did things differently. And the share, it's a 50-50 thing in our household. Actually, you'll find me doing more of the things that will be classed as the feminine stuff. You know, you'll find me doing the cooking. You find me, I mean, I cooked this afternoon. I'm constantly doing that. You find me doing the washing, doing the cleaning. My wife, Candice, doesn't do that stuff. And she says, I'm not going to do it. That's fine. I have no problem with that. I'm more than happy to do it. No problems at all. I went out yesterday. I came back around about, say, around about midnight. I went into the kitchen to load the washing machine up to put clothes on to wash. And when I woke up this morning, I put it out on the line. I have no problem doing that stuff. So, you know, for us, it's that's the kind of split we have. We understand our strengths and weaknesses. I enjoy doing that stuff, so she leaves me to do it. And she enjoys doing other things and I leave her to do it. I don't care the fact that I'm a man and she's a woman. That doesn't matter to us. It's as long as we're playing our part, you know, in the household, you know, in the day-to-day running of our household, nothing else matters. And we don't subscribe to gender norms or whatever. We don't subscribe to that stuff. You know, it's important for me, for my son and my daughters as well, to actually see me do stuff like that. It's very, very important. And my daughters see that I'm the person that does the cooking in the house, so that when they grow up, society or a man somewhere, if they decide, you know, to end up with men, don't tell them that that's what they need to be doing. No, that's not going to happen. It's important that my son sees that kind of stuff as well, so that he doesn't grow up expecting, if he decides to end up with a woman, expecting that that woman is going to, that's the woman's role. No, you've got to learn to look after yourself, young man. You know, you've got to learn how to cook. You've got to learn how to clean. You see me do it, you pick up a Hoover as well and let's get it done together. And that's what's most important.
You kind of spoke to it already, but if you had to kind of concisely describe or define involved fatherhood, how would you describe that?
Involved fatherhood is just, is involving every part of yourself, mentally, physically, emotionally. Everything. You come into it with everything that you've got. Of course, I'm not saying you should lose yourself in the process. No, it's very important that you are actually one with yourself. And that's the only way you can actually bring all of yourself into fatherhood. You know, it sounds a bit complicated, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not. I think as humans, we tend to kind of overcomplicate things in our head. But in the grand scheme of things, it's very, very important as a father that you bring all of yourself. It's important that your children see you feel. It's important that your children get to experience those emotional times with you. So they understand that it's okay to be emotional. It's okay to cry when you need to cry. It's okay to just ask for a hug. It's okay to provide either solutions or comfort. All that kind of stuff is okay. And it's important for us, you know. There's no way I wouldn't walk out if I put my son to sleep. He doesn't let me leave his room until I give him a kiss. He goes, oh, Dad, you're forgetting something. I'm like, oh, yeah, kiss. Here we go. Take a hug. You know, stuff like that's really important. And for me, I just think that's what really matters. Bring all of yourself into it. Forget all that stuff that says you can't be emotional because you're a man. That makes no sense. No sense.
And so I've heard of this term shoulder to shoulder interactions with men and male friendships. I know you've referenced that in some of your writing. And so for listeners that haven't heard that, would you mind telling us what that is? And then also talking to us about how you're trying to reconfigure interactions with your own male friends.
With our male friends. It's very interesting that when I came across it, I thought, woo, that makes perfect sense. I could see that play out throughout whilst I was growing up, because I hated my time at university. I totally hated it, even though I tried to create a version of myself that I was projecting onto the world, but I hated all of it. And that's because a lot of the friendships I had, I've come to understand now, were more shoulder-to-shoulder relationships. Now, the thing is, what we found and what studies have found is that men most especially, mostly, not all, but men mostly bond with their peers on shoulder-to-shoulder relationship. So which means we bond over like common interests, football, you know, soccer, and your side of the world, sports, parties, women, cars. That's what we bond over. Whereas when you see most female relationships, they have more face-to-face relationships. And what that means is they're able to connect on a deeper level. They talk about things that really matter to them, how they feel, what's going on in their lives. They're more open. So it's important to see that. And I saw that play out in my mom's and dad's relationships as well. I saw that play out in my mom's friendship groups. And those women are still friends till today. I refer to a lot of them as mom, even though they're not my biological mother, but I refer to a lot of them as mom. Like, I'll drop anything I'm doing to go see any of them anytime they come visiting. And that's because they've kept this tight relationship where they're able to share everything. You know, they know what's going on with one another. You know, they're able to encourage each other. And that's how they're able to kind of just navigate this world. But then I found in my dad's relationships, it was more, they were kind of like peacocking. It was, what I've got better than you. How I'm better than you, how I'm more of a man, how I run the house, or how I've got a better looking car. There's a lot of that kind of stuff, that meaningless stuff that just doesn't really matter. And in the grand scheme of things, I found that they're not really friends. They're just trying to one-up each other, you know, and who's that helping? It's helping no one, because at the end of the day, when you really have need someone to talk to as a man, there's no one to talk to, because you try to talk, you before you speak to them, you're thinking you're going to get judged because you're going to get looked at like weak or less than, and all of that stuff doesn't help. What I've tried to do with my friendship, and most of the friendships that I have now, they're face-to-face relationships, they're face-to-face friendships. I have a WhatsApp group that I referenced in my book. You know, it's a group of friends, some of my friends, and we've grown up for, you know, together for years, and we are able to share how we really feel with each other. Nothing is off the table. You can come into that group because we're in different parts of the world. There's some of them in Dubai, some of them in the US, you know, some of them over here, and some in Nigeria. And we're able to just actually really share how we feel. It's a space where, you know, one of us just had a baby recently, and he came in there and says, I'm really struggling. You know, I'm really struggling. Nothing I'm doing seems to be right. You know, I'm trying my best, but nothing seems to be right. And the rest of us, without any judgment, are able to come in there and say, look, bro, it's okay. We've all been through that. Just try to understand that in this very moment, you're a support function. Don't try to control anything. Just try to do everything that you can do apart from, obviously, you can't breastfeed the child, but everything else, you do that. You know, that's all you need to do. Stop trying to control stuff. And it's refreshing that we're able to have those kind of conversations. And you can see how all of us feel. So we're able to bring our whole selves into it. And I think we're better for it. I could just imagine how that would look or how that could seem if that's practiced widely, more widely. You know, that would be a wonderful, wonderful place to be. That would be such a wonderful world. Maybe that could actually help with the number of male suicides as well. Maybe that can help with, you know, the number of men that are just breaking down from, you know, loads of stuff. Maybe that can help if we're able to actually open up. I was on LinkedIn the other day and I saw people actually making jokes about men. They've started to open up about the mental pressures of work and stuff like that and mental health. And I saw loads of men laughing about it, saying, oh, no, you just need to suck it up. You see, that's the problem. That is the problem. But imagine if we had more face-to-face relationships so we can actually come with our whole selves and actually share how we really feel and is received positively and what we're getting from those friendship groups of support. It would be a great place. So that's the difference between, you know, the face-to-face stuff and shoulder-to-shoulder. And when I found it, I thought, wow, okay, that right there, that's it. In 1965, white sociologist and Assistant Secretary of Labor, Daniel Patrick Monian, published a report called The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. This report claimed that increasing rates of out-of-wedlock births and single-mother homes among African Americans signaled the coming destruction of Black families, and that these trends were to blame for many of the issues facing the Black community in America. The report has since been criticized by many race scholars, yet even Black public figures have shared statistics from it. In 2008, President Barack Obama said during his Father's Day speech that more than half of all Black children live in single-parent households. Children who grew up without a father are 5 times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in prison.
When you were approached about writing your book, it was because you were such a supportive partner and you were very exuberant about your role in the family. And you were extremely active early on, but the book you ended up writing was very different than the book you set out to write.
Oh, yes.
So I'd love to know what shifted in the direction of the book as you began to write it.
Whew, what shifted? Everything shifted. Everything shifted. That's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life, because what I did there was open myself up and learn a lot of things about myself. The book was a healer for me as well. I tell many people all the time, and I hope people can feel this when they read the book, is I start the book with some kind of anger towards my dad. And then towards the end, I come to a place of understanding. At first, I was going to write a book about fatherhood, how to change diapers, you know, how to support your partner. The current book I've written contains that stuff, but it's a lot deeper than that now, because I just found myself going deeper and deeper and deeper. And look, I've been in therapy for about a year and a half now, and I'm going to continue to be in therapy. I think it's really great. And through therapy, you know, I found myself discussing the book I was writing with my therapist, and she kept on digging deeper, you know, and just opening things up. And I was just saying things blasé, off the cuff. And she goes, no, we're going to circle back to that. No, come back. And I'm like, oh, do we really have to do that? She's like, yeah, let's do it. Let's circle back. Let's explore that. And I found that as we were exploring that, I was getting material, because it was like so many moments of clarity and epiphanies and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, wow, if I was going through that, if I was dealing with that without even realizing, how many more people, men, are going through that kind of stuff or dealing with that kind of stuff and not realizing? So I thought, right, let's get down the paper. Let's write that. Then I also had somebody holding my hands as I was writing the book, and she's absolutely brilliant. And she always knew when I was holding back, because she constantly told me, we need more. Let's dig deeper. Let's go. You know, anytime I wrote something, I thought, yeah, this is brilliant. That's it. Yeah, it's done. And she goes, nah, we need more. I could tell you're holding back. I think you can, you know, expand on that a little bit more. So I ended up writing this book that I felt came from the heart, from the heart, you know, that came from deep down inside. And I realized I didn't want to write a book that was telling people what to do, but just telling people to think for a second, you know, just stop, think about your actions, think about what you're doing, think about what you've learned. Let's start to deconstruct it. Now, if you've got questions and you want to start looking for answers to those questions, then you're on to a winner. That's what my book's about. Not asking people to be like me when you finish reading it. No, not at all. Just want you to start thinking.
I was going to say, it sounds like that's just the book that we need. We don't need another book explaining how to change diapers, how dads can change diapers.
Yeah.
But, you know, doing the deep soul work that happens when you become a parent.
Exactly. And you see what I found as well, this is one of the reasons why I really decided to steer away from a book telling dads how to change diapers. I found out that a lot of men weaponize incompetence. Come on, man.
Jasmine's having a feeling.
Come on, man. You know, let's not do that. So I decided I'm not going to write a book, you know, telling you how to change a diaper. Mm-hmm. You know, how did your wife learn how to change a diaper? How did she learn? No, she learned. You can learn too. Let's go. So I'm not going to do that. You know, I thought I was going to deal with the stuff that comes along, the stuff that's deep down inside, that's deep rooted. I was going to challenge beliefs and thought processes. I was going to challenge the hierarchy. I was going to challenge your thoughts about the patriarchy. I was going to challenge your thoughts about society and your position within society. In extension to that, and by extension to that, your role in your family, you're all in your house. I was going to challenge that. So that's why, you know, for me, that was more important than just saying, well, you take the diaper out of the bag and then you open it up. Like, no, forget that stuff.
And that's you walking the walk in terms of like feeling first, like as you were writing your book, you allowed yourself to go into that place of feeling and follow it to where it was taking you to this new direction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why the book is it's written in a conversational style. You know, I'm having a conversation, you know, and that's why it's written that way, because believe it or not, I'm coming to a lot of realizations whilst writing the book as well. I'm realizing stuff about myself. I mean, writing the book, I dealt with how I felt about calling myself a stay-at-home dad, you know, because even when I decided to become a stay-at-home dad and I became one, I didn't feel good about telling people that I was a stay-at-home dad. And whilst writing the book, I came to reckon with it. It's like, you know what? That's what I am. I'm a stay-at-home dad. I'm going to wear that on my chest and be proud about it. There's nothing wrong with it. So yeah, I'm learning. Just like anyone else that's picking up the book and reading and learning as well, I was learning through the process and I'm still learning stuff about myself. I'm still deconstructing and reconstructing things. I'm always doing that.
Once you settled on the focus, or once you kind of found the direction of the book that you knew you needed to write, what were some of the greatest challenges for you as a stay-at-home dad writing a book and getting the story out that you wanted to tell?
Oof. That was hard. That was really hard. Writing a book, like I said, is not easy. And especially a book like this. I found it difficult. Again, I have a wife that works as well, you know, and she spends a lot of time out of the house and a lot of time in the house too. So I found myself kind of like that. I was the person at the school gate. I'm the person in the WhatsApp group, not my wife. I'm one of the only men in the WhatsApp group. I'm the person that deals with school uniforms and all that kind of stuff. And I had a book to deliver as well. I just paced myself. And the best thing about it is, one thing I do now is I make it clear. Anyone I'm going to do any work with, I make them understand that I'm not going to sacrifice any time with my children for that work. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen, right? So we're going to do it at a time that I'm not doing anything with the kids. For me, that's very, very important. And that's what I did with my book as well. I just made sure that my time with my children was not sacrificed at all. I found a way around and I worked around that. And that was it. Meant I was probably burning a candle at both ends, but it's okay. I got my rest, I wrote my book, and I looked after my children, which was very, very important. So yeah, it was, I had to learn that the hard way as well, because before I became a stay-at-home dad, I worked in the corporate world. And I struggled with the work-life balance stuff. And I think that's one thing I was really looking for. Work-life balance was very important to me. You know, my 8-year-old daughter, till this day, doesn't let me put her to sleep. And that's because while she was growing up, you see, that those most important times, I spent that time on the road, Monday to Friday, going to work. And her mom dealt with that stuff. And she doesn't let me do it now. You know, her mom was working away and I'm here in the house with her. I'm like, right, you know, let me put you to sleep. She knows that I'm cool. I'm okay. I'll put myself to sleep. Mm-hmm. But then she's texting her mom saying, Mom, good night. Can we do the rhyme that we do? Because they have a rhyme that they created from when she was young. And what they've done is every time there's a milestone, they add something to it. You know, they add it to the rhyme. She's like, yeah, can we do the rhyme now? And she's texting her mom. And I'm saying, look, I can do it too. Mm-hmm. But I understand that she's not used to that stuff. She's not used to me doing it. And I'm giving her a space. I'm like, you know what? I respect that. But that wasn't going to happen to me again. No, I wasn't going to let that happen. So it was important that I flipped the script. So yeah, I would always lead with my time with my kids, most important first. When I've dealt with that, then we can do everything else.
What do you hope that your children will learn from you about family and career?
What I hope they learn is, you see, those two things can run simultaneously. You know, one, you don't sacrifice your family for work because you feel, and I know this sounds cliche, I know you hear that and people hear that a lot, oh, it's really important. But it's a fact. Don't sacrifice your family for work, because after all is said and done, your family is the one that's going to be there for you, you know. And if you spend all that time trying to build a career, sacrificing family, you will end up not liking that. You know, you might not like what you see. So it's important for them to just find that balance. That's the beauty of life, finding balance in it. You know, in this world that there's just so much chaos and stuff, if we're able to just see through the noise and through the nonsense and just find that balance, we're on to win, you know, that's a winner straight. You know, for me, I think it's important. And my children see that. Because for me, it's constantly about balance. I get stressed out, you know, but I look for a way to just chill out and come back 100% myself. For me, that's what's most important. Just understand that there is balance in everything. And you will stumble, you will fall, you will make mistakes. That's okay. No problem. You will do all of that stuff, you know, but with time, you will find it in your way, not my way, in your way.
Do you have any advice for a parent that might be considering making the transition from working to being a stay-at-home parent?
Whew. Look, I'm under no illusions. I know finances are very important. I know that. And especially with what's going on in the world today, you know, the cost of living crisis and all that stuff, especially in the UK, it's really bad at the moment. So I understand finances are really important. And people are working more and more now than ever. But if you want to make that step and you want to take that leap, you don't take that step without taking a step. It's just that. I mean, you could do what I did or what I did for a very long time, which was trying to figure out the best time to do it. And I just never did it until I was given a push to get it done. But if you have, say, for example, you have a partner, you know, that you're running the family with, it's always best, it's very important that you actually sit down with that person and figure things out. So figure out the finances is really important. So I'm not asking anyone to just quit their jobs without thinking about how they're going to eat. You have to feed, right? So that's just figure out the finances first in any way, shape or form, you know, how it works for you. Figure that stuff out and then just start to make that transition. I'm not the type to just nip it in the bud and just cut it. No, baby steps. Just take your time and find your rhythm. With time, you can make it happen. That's one of the good things that came out of, you know, the whole pandemic thing where a lot of people started working from home, you know, the use of Zoom and stuff like that. You can speak to your workplace and find out if they offer flexible working. Because quite frankly, most companies need to be doing that now. Companies need to be embracing that stuff now. Speak to them and see if they offer flexible working and spend more time at home and, you know, less time in the office. That makes you feel better about yourself. Yeah, hell yeah. Speak to your company about it. And companies that let you work from home, fine. You know, make that happen. But I think we need to be moving towards that. So it's very important that conversations start to happen. You look at things logically as well. It's important too. And just make sure that you don't just take the leap stupidly. Make sure it works for you. That's the advice I would give. And I know it's pretty unique. It's unique. Every situation is unique. So I'm trying not to just give a direct answer to that. I'm trying to be broad about it because everyone's situation is unique. Mine is unique, and that's quite privileged because there was another income coming into the household, right? So if somebody's looking to do that, they have another income coming into the household, it's worth looking at that. You know, how can that income stretch if one income stops coming? How can we now like stretch things? What can we cut back on? What can we relax on? What can we chill on? You know, how can we just make things work? It's all about communication as well. So yeah, that's my own little bit of advice, if anyone wants to do that.
How would you hope to continue your work around the role of masculinity and fatherhood in society today?
I'd want to speak to more people. I do that a bit. You know, I speak to a lot of the younger generation, so younger men coming up. But I want to do that on a bigger scale, and I'm working towards that. I probably want to write more books. I think I caught the bug. I've caught the bug now. I think I'm mad for catching that bug, but I caught it anyways. Probably want to write some more books, just really focusing on so many topics around masculinity. I mean, I've written a book on fatherhood, and I believe there's some topics there that could be standalone topics as well, where they can become books of their own. And I think it's really important that we start to have these conversations as men. These were conversations that we never had before, you know, especially around the topic of, you know, the shoulder-to-shoulder, face-to-face relationship stuff. You know, I think we can expand more on that and go deeper. Male friendship groups need to adapt and start to get better at, you know, actually just feeling and creating a safe space for other men to come and share how they really feel without fear of being judged.
I know it may be a few years, but do you remember what some of your children's first words were?
Whoa. Okay. Of course, we had a typical dada and mama stuff. Of course, that was, I think that goes without saying. Sheesh, what were the first words? Right. Doc McStuffins. Doc McStuffins. My 8-year-old was in love with that show to a point where she actually developed an American accent when she was younger because she watched a lot of Doc McStuffins. So Doc McStuffins was some of her first words, you know, that she said. My little boy, it was definitely like mama and papa and stuff. And yeah, Helen. So he had a childminder from when he was really young, and her name was one of the first names he actually called. So a lot of his first were actually with her. His first steps, she caught all of that stuff. So Helen was definitely one of the first words he said as well. Yeah.
What was the first thing you said when you saw your children born? I know there was three different scenarios when you met your children, but do you have any recollection of the first words that you said?
Definitely, wow. Definitely that, wow. Because it's happened to me 3 times, and each time I'm like, wow. I'm just, yeah. Wow is definitely, I love saying that a lot. So definitely wow, yeah.
Good one.
What are the first words of your current project?
I meant to start this book by telling who I am, but that's really an open question. What does that mean? I feel like I'm in therapy.
All right. And now this is a word association. So I'm going to say a word and you tell me the first thing that comes to mind, the first word that comes to mind when I say leader.
Father.
Joy.
Children.
Ancestor.
Mother.
Home.
Family.
Passion.
Ah, oh, that's a good one. There's so much that's just come to my mind with passion. There's just so much that's come. Right, passion. Cause.
Support.
Therapy.
Father.
My dad.
That was a big one.
Yeah, that was. That was a big one. That was a big one. That was a big one.
You've been listening to First Words. You can find out more info on this episode's guest and the show on our website, firstwordspodcast.com. If this show resonated with you, please share it with other writer parents in your life. We're in this together. First Words is recorded, edited, and co-produced by James Hilmer.